Okay. To say it's nice to see a full house tonight. I hope you... Well, I think that the articles will engender a pretty good discussion, so I'm looking forward to it. Once again, any general questions before I dive right in to gender and class? Okay, again, just a reminder that if you cannot make it on the peer review day, to let me know so I can hook you up with another person who won't be here. And I think I said in the syllabus that if you don't let me know and don't come to a peer review session, you'll have to like answer a whole bunch of essay questions. I'm hoping not to have to actually write those essay questions. So we'll figure it out. Okay. Plan for the day is we're sort of going to do a very whirlwind introduction to class, which is really, you know, what we've on some level been talking about throughout the course of the semester, but we'll just focus on socioeconomic status, a little whirlwind of gender, and then use the two articles to talk about how those two things interrelate together and how they can be studied and what we can do with that information. I think one of the nice things about both of the articles for this week is they both had, to differing extents, some sort of direct policy implication or a program change or definite recommendations, which I think is a frustration for a lot of the social science literature where it's like, okay, well, you've told me something interesting about this group of people, but now what do we do with it? And then we'll end with sort of a general discussion about how gender can be, should be talked about under the rubric of culture and cultural competency. Okay, so in terms of socioeconomic status, it's always, well, not always, but in modern history, has, you know, sort of health policy people and medical anthropologists and practitioners have been interested in the relationship between socioeconomic status and health. How that attention has been manifested has evolved over time. So some people, you know, will sort of typologize the history, and you can see things like prior to 1985, there was what they call the sort of the poverty era, and talking about a poverty threshold, so that if you were below the level of poverty, that would have a direct impact on your health. If you were above, you know, you had enough resources, you were going to be fine. And it would be interesting to look and see how did that theory made sense with how medicine was organized at the time, in terms of, you know, if it was prior to HMOs, or if it was, if emergency rooms were easier to access, if there were more availability of care in different places. I'm not sure that's a hypothesis I want to support, but so sort of social history of looking at socioeconomic status in relationship to health, that would be an interesting question. Probably all of us went, well, that seems a little simple and probably not true to have this just gradient, you know, above and below, you know, problematic, okay. And in fact, the next phase really started to then make a gradient among different levels of poverty, so that health improved and mortality decreased as you got richer, so that they were possibly, there was a direct correlation, higher economic status, higher, lower mortality, lower morbidity, better health. That gets complicated in the mid-1990s and gets even more complicated in the early 2000s when you start to see in the literature questions of social determinants of health. And the mechanism model, or looking at the social determinants, doesn't just take a correlation between your socioeconomic status and your health, but looks at how does socioeconomic status actually get under the skin to have an effect on somebody's health. You see things in the literature, you know, is this something, what's called social drift, where the idea being that people with poor health status can't maintain jobs or don't have, you know, enough disposable, they use all their income for their health. So the social drift model is that bad health lowers your socioeconomic status because you have to spend all your resources to maintain your, you know, or to try to make yourself better, medications, hospital visits, that sort of thing. You can't work because you're disabled. That's the social drift. The other sort of, which originally was called social causation and has been changed to social determinants, is at what point does it influence one's status? So it's looking at it from a slightly different perspective. But for only a few conditions, and I'm thinking particularly of extreme mental health issues, does social drift really seem to be a good explanation for the correlation between health and lower health, lower socioeconomic status. For most other things, we're looking at mechanisms or determinants. This idea of, you know, how socioeconomic status gets under your skin should sound very familiar in light of our conversation of embodiment a few weeks ago. And you know, it's amenable to the sort of the cultural approach, you know, that body and society in many ways work together, that it's not a unidirectional, you know, we talked about the hypodermic needles and all those other visual analogies we had, but that it really is an integrative process. And looking at what are the determinants that play a role in all of these disparities, in differential diagnosis, differential treatment outcomes, where do these differences lie? And in the literature for today, one of the points of throwing these articles in this week is to look at gender as a social determinant, or how may gender interact in particular ways with societal structures to become a determinant on health. And that's what today's articles do really well. So gender is an aspect of identity that we haven't really isolated out and looked at yet. We haven't really explored it. And in exploring it, one of the goals is to further show some of the problems with this idea of cultural lumping, you know, this, or stereotyping. The reason of putting young black women sexual behavior article with young black men behavior article in a similar social environment of a city will show that, you know, to just say African American, how that can get us on the wrong track. And it's odd because gender, like socioeconomic status or race or whatever demographic variable we're looking at, carries certain disparities across the board. So in general, men have higher mortality rates. Females have a longer life expectancy. I think for the majority of all leading causes of death, the risk of death is higher for men. Whereas women show a higher morbidity and a higher health utilization of healthcare services. So excluding reproductive health and controlling for socioeconomic status, women between 17 and 44, 45 are 30% higher users of ambulatory care, 15% more physician visits, and it's not until you get to the elderly that men start to outpace women in terms of their long-term hospital stays and the frequency of doctor visits. Women use 50% more over-the-counter medications than men, and men, again, in that same sort of age group, 17 to 45, have more injuries, more reported vision and hearing problems, and higher levels of life-threatening chronic diseases. Yes.
We're just talking about America here.
Yeah, or you know, Canada,
America. Okay, North America.
Yeah, the West.
The West.
We'll lump it all in the West. And that's actually my next sort of page of notes is what types of categories of explanations have been put forward to explain the gender disparity. And the first one, a lot of people do look internationally or cross-nationally, because one of the categories of potential explanations is a biological risk. So tying it not only to sort of the genetics of populations, but also the genetics particular or the physiological processes particular to women. Some people have tried to show evidence that women have greater genetic resistance to infectious disease. Others have argued that perhaps women are better protected by their particular hormones from particularly cardiovascular morbidity. Problem is there isn't really that much evidence to support the contention that men and women differ in the sort of pathology and pathophysiology of different diseases. But it's out there. Others will look and try to say, well, what perhaps is unique to women that would give them a different level of an acquired risk of illness or disease? And this can go both ways. So the stay-at-home mom, women have less job stress may contribute to their lower levels of certain diseases. Or flip side, women doing double duty, working outside the home and raising kids, may raise stress levels, which will have an impact on their health. I don't want to stop and talk about these because I want you to see the theme that's going to run through all of them. Related to that, psychosocial aspects. The idea that women are taught from an early age to be more aware of their bodies than men, to have a greater ability to complain about their health. They don't have that stiff upper lip, men don't complain. The childhood socialization model. Others have said that, women, because they are less powerful and the weaker sex, are more comfortable adopting the sick role. So they will express the sick role more often, therefore having those higher rates of healthcare utilization, and therefore general better health. Others just think that because women, but that there's a difference in health reporting behavior, that women are thought to be more complete and detailed in physician interviews, and that women are thought to recall minor health problems better than men. In large part because they also have to monitor the health status of their children, so they're sort of used to being on top of all these sort of things. The having to go to pediatricians' appointments and knowing sort of what questions are asked and what's looked for, they're better able to look for that in themselves. A fifth category of explanation is the idea that maybe there's some sort of physician sex bias. Maybe practitioners treat female patients differently than they treat male patients. And that could be a means to explain the gender disparities. What do we notice about all of these categories as sort of a collective? The note to myself would sound familiar? ?
When it's like black or white, man or woman.
Yeah. Say more about that.
Using race as an example of characterizing disease specifically to African Americans or specifically Africans.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to tease out because there's two different ways that I can interpret what you just said, and they're both right. But I just want to make sure we're all talking about both. Is that in the same way that the literature in terms of understanding disparities can often be homogenizing of groups, we see that here. But there's another aspect to it where the explanations, what's the source of the explanation for all of the, in all of these categories? Yeah. Right, that it's the beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors of the women themselves. In the same way we saw, blacks don't trust the healthcare system, which is why they don't do this. Asians don't want to be told, which is why they don't do this. It's all focused in the worldview of the patient. This is key. Does this make sense? So what would be the opposite? If we can express what the opposite would be, we're all on the same page. If we're saying there's a problem in placing the explanations in the beliefs, attitudes, behaviors, the psychosocial aspects of the people.
Well, looking instead at the behaviors of the physicians and the medical system that treats these women, it seems like that one that you mentioned, that do physicians treat female patients different than males, would sort of qualify.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what else? There's at least one other thing that I'm thinking of that could be put under that rubric of what else could be looked at.
Yeah. Are men underutilizing the healthcare system? I mean, if you want to take the shift away from like women being too sensitive or whatever, then you know, the reverse.
Yeah, it's always interesting to look and see what is the standard upon which we are claiming is the norm to then have a disparity.
I guess also maybe like the relationship between men and women, like maybe like, I don't know. I'm just trying to like think, like brainstorm, but I don't know how.
What determines relationships between men and women? I mean, not solely, but what is a influence?
Like culture, society, TV, family, friends.
Yeah. Social structure.
Right.
Yes, exactly. That's what I just wanted to reiterate. You have what, 4 weeks left? Usually when I say, what else am I thinking? Structural aspects is probably the answer. Or something around there. Yeah, exactly. So the question that this leads us to is, how do gender and class relate? And can we study one apart from the other?
Certain forces you probably can, but in other, if you're looking at other aspects, you really need to look at both of them. For instance, I mean, women do the bulk of childcare, and since they do the bulk of childcare, they found in the 50s women are much more likely to acquire symptomatic poliomyelitis than men, probably because the fecal oral transmission and they perform all the diaper changes. And today we see it because, again, with the daycare centers, there's an article in the Journal of Infectious Disease about 2 years ago called Daycare, the New Tropical Isle. So, again, they're exposed to pathogens that their partner may not see. So that, in that sense, I think that's probably going to be class-independent, where there's some that are going to be class-dependent, such as access to a clinic. I mean, women who are more likely, because there are reproductive health care issues, they tend to come into contact with the medical system. They also take kids to the pediatrician. And there's that donut hole of the too rich for Medicare or for commercial insurance. It tends to get less medical care. So that would be less gender specific, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, I am rarely one to make an absolute answer. So yes, Dick's point that there are certain times where it is and certain times where it isn't possible. But what the two articles for this week, they obviously don't. They're presenting a very contextualized picture of behavior and explanatory models from inner city women and men about HIV and AIDS risk behavior. Sobo at one point says black men and women interact with white society. Black men and women who interact with white society encounter different kinds of barriers. So he's not just saying men and women, he's saying men and women in a particular social situation will encounter very particular barriers. They'll encounter some that are the same and some that are different. Now, I had said last week that these two articles should not be taken as sort of state-of-the-art information. And we're going to sort of examine that contention a little bit more. So what I want us to spend some time on is asking, what is different in 2011 from the mid-90s? And what is the same? And use that as sort of a lens for discussion. So what I'm handing out are from a, I think it's a nonprofit, AVERT, or AVERT HIV, AVERT AIDS. There's one chart that breaks down percentages of new AIDS diagnoses in 2009 compared to percent of the population in 2008. The population always, numbers always lag a little bit. Here, I have an extra. I did 35, but we aren't in the house today. Everybody get one? Or some? Okay. The second is breaking down HIV and AIDS new diagnoses by race and ethnicity and gender. And the bottom is just a illustrative pie chart with HIV diagnoses. Because both of the articles talk about this, about particularly the fact that you're approaching a 50% of all new diagnoses of HIV, or AIDS in this case, in the United States, are people that would be demographically labeled black. But they correspond, the black population is only 12% of the United States population. And that's pretty darn close to whatever number Whitehead shows for like 1995. And the male-female ratio, not that different from what he puts out there. And the most recent numbers that I could find in terms of prison populations, which is another thing that Whitehead talks about, is that 30% of prison population in the United States is black men. 16% Hispanic males. And what's interesting about this is that not just the fact that men will disappear from society for a while, but when they come back, they are also, in fundamental ways, disenfranchised. So the prison time is not just a time outside of the family in terms of support. It also extends to possibilities later.
What does that mean, multiple races?
Probably people who check more than one box. Mm-hmm. I think that Whitehead's general thesis that a study of gender identity can help understand risk behavior is a valid thesis for today as well. So I want to open up the discussion a little bit, and I want to keep this, I have sort of three things I want to do next. I want to talk about common themes and relationships between the two articles to sort of set the stage, and then we can talk about details of, okay, well, then we'll break it down by the sexes. But what are some of the general themes that emerged from these two being read in relation to each other?
Mm-hmm. That just stating facts in an educational way without interpreting culture is not going to work. People have kind of talked about that.
Right, that increasing knowledge has absolutely no relationship to changing behavior. Yeah. And Sobo actually, on page 461, says, it's just a little sentence fragment. The choice of an option depends on all of its features, not just the risks. I think that's just a really neat point to keep in mind, because a lot of the prevention literature focuses on avoiding risk. What else?
Can I just explore that for a second?
Yeah.
I'm a little confused about that because it
guess when it comes down to is avoiding risk, just what's the right context, the right sort of focus about sort of avoiding the risk. Did I have that wrong?
But that risk need to be put in context? Or
so that you can quantify risk just with an arbitrary number like we were talking about before, but if you understand what the two risk factors, I thought this is where it was going. You have to understand culturally within the context of what the true risk factors are to really sort of avoid the risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, so the raw numbers might lead you to a different solution, which it unless you understand what the true risk factors are, the numbers, you're just imputing your own bias into the numbers about what the true risk factors might be.
Now, are you talking about true risk factors for a population or for an individual?
Both.
Because I think what, I don't know if EJ is a he or a she, I was taking it much more on a very particular level, that a particular person in a particular situation, context, right, that a particular percentage of, you know, you may have this possibility, this will relate, this may turn into this, needs to be made sense of in that particular context. And that there are other, and that's the whole sort of point of her article, what are the other benefits that are being weighed against the risks? What else is similar or... Yeah.
I mean, they both talk about the systematic, broader aspects of the cultures that these people are embedded in that can encourage higher rates of HIV transmission.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They both reference incarceration, for example. Which was a white hip is much more specific about crack cocaine and whatnot, but
yeah, and that's what I really, and this is a, sort of a little pre, our last week we talk about we're sort of extending culture, and instead of looking at different cultures here, we're looking at what is this Western culture, what happens when it goes outside the West. One of the things that the authors in that week will talk about is there's a sort of culture of modernity. And I think a large part of that, a subset, is the culture of the city. And that's not a typical way that we think about what culture is. But I think if you look at everything that culture is, you know, a set of structural constraints, structural opportunities, who you interact with, what are you exposed to, it makes perfect sense to talk about a culture of the city. And this is a little bit of why I asked Dr. Redhawk to come talk to us next week, because she's a practitioner who has worked in Philadelphia and has experiences with what does healthcare look like under these particular constraints for a large percentage of the population of Philadelphia. I have in my notes, culture of the city, Sobo 456. What did I think was so interesting on page 456? The condition. Oh, I'm in the second paragraph in the first section. The conditions of life in the inner city make unsafe sex among those who live there particularly likely to lead to HIV infection. Economic oppression and the effects of this on gender relations, substandard health care, and the frequency of IV drug use, high rates of untreated venereal infection, and other typical inner city and poverty-related conditions exacerbate the effects that unsafe practices have on the rate of HIV transmission among blacks. What else sort of came bubbling to the top looking at both of these together?
That a lot of decisions or behaviors are shaped by subjective societal norms more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Right, sort of what does it mean to be a woman,
right,
or a man or in this situation?
Right. I think it was Sobo that said it's not necessarily economic. all the time, that it's more about that person and their community and what is deemed, I guess, like salient in that community.
Yeah, I thought that was one of, and Whitehead, you're right, Sobo talks about it more than Whitehead, but this idea that, how do they phrase it? There's an intuitive logic in generalized Western culture of why people behave a certain way. And the intuitive logic attached to African Americans is, you know, that, well, that's why women get men pregnant, is to have a baby. You know, this is what's on all the debates, you know, the welfare parents, you know, or the, even taking it internationally, the, what's it called when you drop off a baby?
Anchor babies.
And there's some interesting inconsistencies in this popular wisdom that we'll get to later. But the idea that there is this intuitive logic, she says, has made it so that these topics haven't been studied that much. Because we all think we know why so many young black women are having babies. You know, and she does, I think, a really good job of saying there's all this other stuff. And I really appreciated how many times she said, upon further study, I think we're going to find that love and emotion actually has a lot to do with this, which is often denied, you know, the stereotypical African-American woman in the literature.
I think what was really salient for me is sort of the relationship that both, you know, African-American men and women share to the condom, which I didn't really think about, and they go through a lengthy description to describe what it means to actually use a condom, and counterintuitive to what I personally think, but makes much sense when they both describe it, is that using it for men is a sign, you know, that you're not sleeping with, you know, bad people, or for women that you're not sleeping with, you know, someone who has an infectious disease. And so that seems strange to me that you use it to signal to your partner that you're not cheating and that, you know, you don't have an STD and that they place trust in you. But, of course, that only increases the risk. But when they describe it, it makes, you know, it does make sense. And I wish there were more research on how different races construct the idea of the use of condoms and what it means culturally to use a condom. Like, is it frowned upon? Is it, you know, like how is that a barrier to condom use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, Whitehead, he lays it out particularly well. This, what you're talking about, this, the constructs of sociocultural meaning. What do condoms mean? You know, if you listen to the prevention literature, they mean safer sex. They mean, you know, you're probably not going to get pregnant. But, you know, for the subjects in these two studies, condoms mean you don't trust me. You think I'm sleeping around. I think you're sleeping around. I'm diseased. I think you're diseased. And then what's interesting is all of the different explanations for why condoms are unnecessary for the particular subjects.
And also for procreation. When you want to have a baby, even if there is infection, you just don't use the condom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dick?
The thing that wasn't there, and I don't know if the data is out there, but what are the attitudes of lower-class European Americans towards condoms? I mean, are there similar attitudes for similar reasons?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Because, I mean, Whitehead seemed to offer us the alternative of that reputational versus respectable approach to relationships.
And he does, I think what I liked about him is that he talked about how these are American values.
Yeah.
That every American man on some level expresses and deals with. That could be a paper topic for those of you who haven't come up with a paper topic yet.
Yeah, and I think the social function of condoms is overshadow its original protection function. So that's why it is associated with the kind of stigma and unfaithfulness. That's why most men and women refuse to use it. So it also go back to the slinky theory and the social constructionism. I think it has a lot of associations.
Mm-hmm.
And I have read a book about in another anthropological class. It's called The Invisible Cure. It's also about HIV and AIDS. The author compares the HIV and AIDS conditions in South Africa and Uganda. it says there is a huge drop of the rate in Uganda is because people talk about it openly. Mm-hmm. And that, in, for example, the taxi driver may talk about it just like talking about football. Mm-hmm. They deal with it very comfortably. So when they openly talk about it, they lower the stigma that is attached with this disease. However, in South Africa, people think it's such a shame, and they would rather die than admitting that they are infected with HIV or AIDS. And when they talk about it, they say the century disease or something, use an euphemism to cover this kind of disease. Mm-hmm. So they still have that stigma. Mm-hmm.
Those of you who were with me this summer, this should all sound very familiar. We had a whole unit on how HIV prevention policies have worked differentially in different settings.
Well, talking seems to be a good segue for what I was thinking in terms of the symbolic meaning of the condoms, as you were mentioning, and how it seems to imply distrust between the partners, and also implies that there isn't really much communication going on. They're simply going on the symbolic meaning in the community of condom usage. Mm-hmm. So you would think that misunderstandings would be cleared up if people are honestly communicating. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I walked away with.
Mm-hmm. So the difference between sort of these populations, or, you know, sort of hypothesizing about Dick's question, sort of lower class European Americans, and how they would probably both differ in similar ways from. One of the articles mentions how the safer sex use a condom message really resonated with the gay population. And I think that just probably has to do with sort of the social history of HIV and AIDS and where it came from, and different notions of what does it mean to be safer, what does it mean to protect the group. I don't know. It's just sort of where I was. My mind spiraled that way. I'll think about it on the way home. Yeah.
One concern I had, and I don't know if it's valid or not, but White had several times his paper, or I think must have been six times, that I'm a black man when he was talking about his interviewing technique. And Sobel mentioned the fact that nearly all her interviewers were European Americans. And given the fact that she was using European Americans to interview African American women, could that have biased the information she obtained? Because there's no way that I could see it of her validating her observations.
Mm-hmm. What did you guys think about that methodologically?
Well, she noted several times that like she thought that they were saying what she wanted to hear in terms of like their usage and things like that.
Yeah, which is why she spent a good amount of time talking about her recruitment strategy and her particular methodologies about when the interview happened. There's a few things that make me think that they did develop enough of a rapport. Like at one point she said we were supposed to have done interviews, but the conversation got so heated I didn't bring it up. And that to me is, okay, she is a respectful interviewer, and that these women felt comfortable enough to continue the discussion in a heated way, almost, particularly with the focus group, which is where the data originally came from. In a focus group, you're going to be much less concerned, I think, about, as opposed to a one-on-one interview.
Well, she also was working with already established focus groups, which I also thought was key. Mm-hmm. So the rapport was already established, and personalities had emerged. Mm-hmm. So it did seem that they were comfortable, and I didn't see a bias as a result of that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to say that there's, even when the interviewer looks like the person they're interviewing, there's still a bias there, because there's an insider-outsider still going on. One person's a researcher and the other person is being researched in a way. So that's still going on even if you look alike. So there's pros and cons, I guess, to both of them.
It's an unavoidable risk. Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, I realized that I had been jumping forward with the assumption, because I found both of these articles really well written, well reasoned, and when I think about, you know, that one of the questions, and this is all sort of a good point for when you go to write your papers, this is all we have unless we are going to be doing research on these topics ourselves. So how do you determine sort of validity in these types of arguments? You know, does the population make sense in terms of the questions that are being asked? Does the methodology make sense to get answers to the questions that are being asked? And does the author provide enough evidence in these cases in the form of these women's and men's particular words and, you know, percentages of respondents who responded a certain way to support their assertions of a conclusion? And I think they both do very well. And I guess I would like to just pause here for a minute. If there's somebody sitting here stewing, going, I thought these articles were crap, you know, shoot, do we have to spend the next hour talking about all the good things that came out of them? I guess I kind of wanted to pause and step back and see if anybody was blood pressure rising.
I wasn't blood pressure rising. Okay. I really liked the article a lot. The only part that I sort of questioned was at the end of the Sobo article where she starts talking about the numbers and she talked about two women versus one, and that was like, it was such a small sample that to me it was almost like, just seemed like that. You could only make general statements about that particular group, like right there. You couldn't really generalize it. And I thought she maybe tried a little bit too hard to generalize it, but it's kind of a relatively minor issue in the context of the article.
And I would venture to say that every qualitative researcher who's written a paper like this has done that. You bury your numbers in the beginning and you start talking about percentages at the end, and unless it's too glaring, you can try to get away with it. It's not right, but we all do it. Right, so then that's really sort of where I wanted to take this discussion partly today is, and Whitehead says, at some point, what does he say? The reader is also warned against generalizing to all African-Americans or to all low-income African-Americans or to all African-Americans or low-income African-Americans residing in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. You know, what do you do with that? Yeah, Jennifer.
Kind of on a related issue, my reaction to both of these articles, well, it didn't make my blood pressure rise. I wasn't thrilled because I'm sitting here going, you know, if we're all fish swimming in this tank, we're fish too, and, you know, as a white woman, I'm sitting here looking, okay, they chose to study the fish with the blue tails here, and they're all making all these comments about them, and then they're, but yet, you know, okay, I have a red tail. Maybe, you know, I could be studied too, and they could come to these conclusions about my behavior, and there were just so many value judgments in here. And I did actually like the Sobo article when she came down to, it really may be all about position, society, and love and fidelity, and that is kind of a universal. You were very stigmatizing, and it was just like putting people in buckets of this is the way this group is, and that made me kind of nuts.
Okay.
I got just from that, for example, that very opening statement that we just talked about. You know, make sure you don't generalize to all African Americans, mm-hmm. low-income African Americans, Baltimore. That said to me, this guy is very aware that he's not trying to bucket people. He's trying to make sure that you don't read this and interpret him as bucketing people. Mm-hmm. So, in that way, I thought he was self-conscious and reflexive about the effect that his research could be interpreted, and wanted to make very clear that that is not how he wanted it to be interpreted.
Mm-hmm. That to me was a cover your ass comment. I mean, because he really, he made that comment and then he went on with these broad generalizations about, and you're going to read the article and most people are going to interpret it about broad audiences. And why else would you have written the article? I mean, he's begging the question, we need more research, we need to do more in a broader perspective.
It's sort of the nature, though, I sort of agree with you, but it's sort of the nature of this, you know, of this type of, you know, of this type of research, where you're sort of pulling on these social, cultural sort of issues. So you're pulling broadly, but looking at a small, defined population. So You do the same thing in epidemiology. You say you can't generalize from the small population outwards, but yet you're sort of taking these broad concepts and sort of the way the world quote unquote sort of works and how that affects this small subgroup, but just by inference it sort of implies that it's sort of a broader conclusion, especially around some of the social cultural issues.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Yeah, two comments in response to this row. The first is that, yes, I mean, I'm glad you said that the same thing happens in epidemiology and other types of research, but it's not as evident because you're dealing with large databases and numbers. And as long as you've got a p-value, you're sort of like, there's a general, I think, more comfort level with taking data that's presented in that way as more true, because your samples are larger, you've done statistics on them, they just sort of have an aura of applicability. Okay, well
I'm looking at it from a different sort of way. I mean, it's, just depends upon what hypothesis you have, where you draw your sample from, and so what conclusions you want to draw. So if you're looking at a narrow population, you can't generalize that.
Right, so that makes...
Whether you have a large or small sample size, it's still not generalizable because it doesn't represent...
Well, that's my second point. We need to distinguish what it is we're generalizing. That's a huge distinction. Are we generalizing the specific results? Or, which I think is what he's saying, no, you can't generalize specific results. But what you can do is generalize an orientation. You can generalize the truth to the hypothesis that gender identity plays a role in sexual risk behaviors. And that, I think, is the fine line that these guys are walking. And then to sort of extend it out and say, okay, gender identity has to be understood in relation to gender, class, and ethnicity.
Yeah, but that's right. You have to read the sort of research in different ways. So what you were just saying, is sort of directional. Yes, there's an influence. And I think, you could probably walk away with that sort of conclusion, but what do you do with that information?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? Especially if they're trying to get towards sort of conclusions about what next steps are and what to do with.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think there was more of that, sort of more of that implication in the one that was written about women.
Mm.
For example, so are those valid conclusions? Is this what our intervention should be?
Mm-hmm.
Or how can I generalize that? Is that an intervention for this population, or how can I generalize that, across different populations? And then how can I figure that out?
Mm-hmm. I guess in some ways I'm making an analogy in my head to, like, going back to Kleiman's questions. The questions are not in and of themselves generalizable to everybody, but the importance of asking the questions is.
Sure, but those are for individuals too. What about for mm-hmm. You're a policy person,
right?
Now, you're trying to make trying to decide what policy is across different. So mm-hmm. if you take the construct issue, you could, it's an infinite regress. Okay, you could chop populations based upon a million different risk factors and put them in little boxes and say we're going to do this for this one.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sort of figure out where to generalize?
Mm-hmm. And that's the $10,000 question. Jim?
Your statement about, I'm not sure I'm understanding, your statement about what the authors are commenting on in a global sense, what I wrote down was gender identity plays a role in sexual risk behavior. That's not revolutionary. I mean, you could go back and research the introduction of the pill, when... what happened when abortion was around, what happened when prophylaxis started.
Mm-hmm.
That's always played a role. It's just, what's the risk? It's been a different dynamic at each stage over history. And because they applied it in a different setting, that's not a unique finding. Gender identity has always played a role in risk behavior. Over time. It just depends what you're studying.
Right.
So what actually, I thought the articles had to be more than that, because that wasn't doing it for me.
Okay, two hands shut up. So Edmund and then Emily. or Emily. Ladies first? Should we go with gender constructs?
Well, I just was thinking, I found both of these articles, what they were saying is, like, we see what seems to be hints of certain relationships, therefore we think we need a lot more research in this particular area. So I found them as sort of directing future research that will then direct policy. I didn't think that they were suggesting that policy follow this, their research right here. I guess I sort of felt, I felt like they were sort of shedding light on what they thought might be some, you know, relationships that need more attention.
Mm-hmm. And to go back to what we said in the very beginning, that there's such a perceived understanding of, or you know, right, of what this group is all about.
Yeah.
Well, I thought both articles well expressed the complex interplay, and they both came up with kind of minor policy recommendations tempered with the call for more research. But I think that, you know, as it's required, basically. But you know, I think that they. I was especially impressed by Whitehead's historical references too, and I just thought those were very comprehensive, mm-hmm, in the plantation society. But you know, I think both just demonstrated, and even kind of implied, that we're offering insights here that maybe, as you suggested earlier, wouldn't appear in the mainstream thought process regarding what is going on in this particular community. For instance, you know, someone like a Bill O'Reilly would just spew some crap about welfare moms or something like this, and the higher rates of HIV/AIDS and pregnancy. And I think they provided plausible explanations, at least, or starting points to get more information.
And in fact, that's a great transition to talking just in more in depth first about the Sobar article, because she was called in as an anthropologist in order to address a particular, you know, what, you know, this sort of, why is this happening? You know, why are our messages falling upon deaf ears? You know, we need some better information about this population. So we have to keep in mind, you know, that that's why she sort of came into this, and that's where this article is coming from. So let's focus on, does anybody know, I'm just, or should I just keep calling Sobo or her? Or we could say Z. Is that catching on, like, in society in general? I guess I just happen to have a lot of transgender friends, so, like, a lot of my Facebook friends are posting, you know, Z thinks this. You know about the Z-E? The gender-neutral pronoun? Oh. Yeah. Apparently in my circles. No, look it up. I mean, it's kind of the next step of people calling for women to be spelled W-O-Y-M-N. You know. I went to Santa Cruz in the 90s. That's what we did. Okay, so let's look at the Sobo article, Women, Inner City, and AIDS. Again, just to sort of circle back and set the stage, one of the places that she starts from is saying that there is a stereotypical or traditional focus on materialist terms. And when people talk academically about inner city African-American women, that it ignores love and emotion. Which is it's interesting, because if you look at the complete 180 other social stereotype about, I don't know, probably less about black women than black men, is sort of this hypersexualized. So, you know, you have sort of sex doesn't mean anything because it's all about procreation in materialist terms versus a hypersexualization. So, I mean, it's interesting, you know, to your point about Jennifer, who I'm pointing to, you know, the sort of feeling like people could study my group and write about them, you know, and make conclusions. I think that particularly in cases in which there is such rampant stereotypes and hypotheses about a group, that research subjects, when they can recognize that the researcher is invested in them as a group, do not find it offensive or disempowering. I think in many ways, and I've done some interviews with stigma and sickle cell, there is this sense of, thank you for listening to me. And I'm going to recognize that you have a social position that I don't. To get the word out, you can get my voice. And if the researcher does it well, then it does. It's not that the subject is powerless. It's sort of by choosing to share, gains a little bit of power.
My point isn't so much that as we are as much a them as this population could be. In other words, that doesn't come out at all. Right? You can understand that one. There is a valid reason for studying this population. There's a need to affect behavior changes because of what is literally going on in disease populations. And so it's not that there's not a valid reason for doing what these researchers did. It's a matter that I think it's important to appreciate that it's not a them versus us. Just as the population that which I am a part of or you are a part of could just as easily have that lens turned on them for a different reason. Mm-hmm. And so it's... The tone of it's a them, we're studying them, I reacted to that.
It's interesting, it's funny because I didn't notice that he said he was a black man multiple times. I only remembered it once. And then Carolyn, when you said something else about someone, she pointed something out multiple times, I was like, oh, I only read that once. So it's just interesting sort of where I chose to forget things.
And part of it may be that, I'm coming from 10 years working in an inner city hospital. Yes, I'm white, but I spent a lot of time working with people of lots of different races, and I don't feel like that's a them. It's a part of the community I belong to. It was one of those arrows that affected my swing. So
you're one of the good ones.
I don't know about that. I don't feel like it's a them to be put under a microscope.
Okay, well, three hands shot up. So, Jamie, did you still want to? I saw your hand first.
Yeah, I just thought when we're talking about is the take home message gender plays a role in decision making or plays a role in HIV.
Or plays a very particular role when combined with this thing called
right.
class
right.
and race
yeah.
in a particular
I
location.
Mean, I would, for me, the
there you go.
that to me is not the take home message, because if you're then looking at another group and you say, oh, well, it's gender, that's not going to get you anywhere. Like, just taking the specifics from this group and saying, oh, well, that must be what's going on here, or going the opposite way and taking the more broader stance, oh, it must be gender, that doesn't help you get anywhere into solving your own specific problem somewhere else, or understanding what's going on in a particular location. To me, what's valuable about this kind of research is working from the specific to the broad and figuring out where the patterns are generalizable and where they aren't. And I mean, at every step, there's certain things that are generalizable and certain things that aren't. But when you stop at just picking on the specifics or just picking up the broad parts, you kind of lose what's helpful or can be used to apply to other situations.
Very well said. Are you responding directly to Jamie's point?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, I was going to say, like, I'm rereading parts of Sobo, trying to understand, like, where one might feel that the generalization that both researchers make might cause one to take a step back and say, well, wait, is this really a generalization? Should we really be making policy recommendations from this? And I do see the point. Like, there's this one point where she mentions how a group of African-American men come into the focus study and they spout this theory that AIDS is a conspiracy to wipe out black people, and then she talks about how the women talk about it, and so this therefore becomes this tangent on how she went to a bookstore and this guy talks about, well, it's more likely that men buy books on AIDS conspiracies. And And then she makes, or he or she makes, sort of a statement about how that might affect gender constructions within the African-American community on what AIDS is and how it affects the community. And I do see that that could be problematic because that is obviously an extrapolation.
And supported by cross-cultural evidence, though, on that one anyway.
Right, right. And I see the problem with it, but I think that I agree with your point that this is much more directional than it is trying to... I mean, I think that as long as the reader understands, and whether or not, you know, Whitehead is trying to cover his butt with his comment on, like, don't generalize, I think that we as a reader also need to understand that we're putting some of our own biases into it, and since I'm not from the community, I am very cautious to make sure that I'm not overgeneralizing. Because I don't want to make generalizations about the African American community as someone who's not African American, but then I have to recognize that I have a bias that wants me to not be biased, and therefore I can't be, you know, like.
Then you start acting all weird, and nobody trusts you.
It's like Inception, but you have to. I think there's sort of like the reader has certain duties to take into account, like, you know, this is what it is, and as long as I'm aware of potential biases. Mm-hmm. You know, I can use this as directional. And I don't think either researchers claim that these are, like, facts of the community, but it's directional orientation. And this is just their hypothesis based on, mm-hmm. on what they've done.
And you know what's interesting is that more and more research now in the past not too many years, it has an abbreviation, community-based...
participatory research.
Thank you. Where doing something the anthropologists have been doing for a long time with different groups is taking... analyses back to the community or involving community members directly as researchers in direct response to these types of criticisms. And again, not to say that just any person from any community is an expert in that community. That's not what this research is saying, because that's, I don't think, true. But it does sort of create, the idea is let's create partnerships between community members and academic researchers, and that's, you know, in the ideal world, that will then have multiple benefits because more people in the community, young kids, will see, oh, hey, I can have a career doing something like this. I can go into science, you know, or I greater possibilities, which would lead to more, you know, people of color primary investigators, you know, which will just sort of flesh out all of these different pictures. Yeah, I've spent Friday morning at a Fox Chase, the Color of Science Day. It's a Fox Chase Lincoln University partnership, and it was really inspiring to hear these young kids talk about how they decided to go into the basic sciences and, you know, euthanize rats, and MRI them. Anna,
Is it Allison? I'm sorry. Jennifer, I want to respond to your comment about the, like, us versus them, and I think I got just a little bit of whiff of that, and I think one of the reasons was that these articles seem to come into the study with the assumption that the right thing for the men and women involved was to use condoms, and that was going to be the solution, and I don't know that, like, it certainly didn't feel like the community thought that was the right thing to do, and so I felt like the whole time it was just like, let's figure out why they're not doing the thing we want them to do. I don't remember which one. One of them, it seemed like they were getting it, like that maybe let's involve the community and try to map out a way to eradicate new diagnoses of HIV, but it still felt a little bit like, let's just try to convince them that this is the right thing to do. And that was like the biomedical model of, like, the most important thing is health, and let's ignore the social aspect of what it's going to mean to use a condom in that relationship.
Well, it's interesting to sort of take the slinky of why this type of research is being done. You know, it comes from national funding agencies and organizations that look at national disparities. And again, what's the standard by which a disparity is measured? So sort of like to make sense of why they're approaching it from this angle, it does make sense. You know, and that's where the research money is as well. Sort of, was it reminiscent of the end of life sort of discussion we had where the cross-cultural stuff, it's like, you need a living will, you need an advanced directive. and why do Asians not have them, and why do Hispanics not have them?
And I think there's an article, did we read it for this class, or might have been for my med school class, about an Indian woman who chose to marry a man she knew had HIV. Is this
right? Not us.
Okay, so the same sort of idea of like, why are there all these people in India who aren't talking about HIV? And it turned out like they all knew. They were all very aware of like who was infected, and women were choosing to, young women were choosing to marry men who were infected because to them it was more important to establish a family, to establish these ties than their health.
I think that's one of the things Sobo talks about too, is how we, because how we attempt to rationalize the seemingly irrational. And that's sort of where attention goes. This doesn't make sense.
What really helped me was to read the notes from both articles. Mm. I wrote like the note number one.
In the Sobo case?
Yeah, for Mr. Tony Eric. And the note number five for Sobo. Where they say, what explain in certain way why they are doing, why they choose African American. And yet they said they ignore the majority of African Americans who are no lower income. Mm-hmm. And he recognized that, but he still choose that low income group of African American. Mm-hmm. And here, Soho said the women participate in the same socioeconomic group. Had the same cultural background. They tried to, in certain way, to put those variables closer together. Mm-hmm. And I think if you remember statistics, in statistics there is a very good way to determine with a very small sample. Sometimes you know the theory, apply the theory properly, you should be able to get very good conclusions of a study with a small population that can help you to understand the greater population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, I try to avoid statistics, but I think what you're saying is very similar to what I said earlier in terms of how you measure validity.
Yeah.
And if you've done it anthropologically well, you're going to have the same congruence. Dick, did you want... No? Okay.
Yeah, I have a question. So I guess for those of us who might be interested in either like exploring this topic more, or I guess just for policy change, you know, a lot of what seems to be discussed as very helpful are cultural discussions, emotional discussions, right? Like this irrational aspect. And one thing that was salient to me in Sobo was this idea that for women, their health might be a secondary concern to having a family and having this bond with the male, like a husband or a spouse. And so, you know, how do you translate that into a policy? Like, how do you teach people to do that? Because I don't think you're going to, like, be able to encourage some sort of fear campaign by saying, like, you don't want your child to have HIV/AIDS, you don't want to, like, have a, you know, family if you're not, like, doing this or that. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder, is there research on how you translate these cultural findings into effective policy? Because I find policy has traditionally had a hard time dealing with cultural differences and with you know, irrational...
And qualitative data.
Right, yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. So we have two strikes against this chair.
Right. So how do we tackle this problem then, I guess?
That is a huge question. And, yes.
So people do community-based participatory research. I just heard a talk earlier today at the School of Nursing, a job talk that somebody was doing. And so she's been working with adolescent African-American girls in West Philadelphia with sex practices and HIV transmission for about 10 years or so. And they start everything they do, they start off with focus groups, and then they move on to do quantitative work after that. And they found out that something they thought actually had an effect, so now they've they've got funding for a randomized control trial that they're going to do to check and see on a broader scale if whatever this intervention is that they're developing will work. And then after that, it would be, I guess, because the RCT is supposedly gold standard, that it wouldn't be a policy per se, but it would be more something that the community would adopt as something to help the community.
So maybe the community, like itself as a unit, knows best how to work within like, you know, its cultural aspects. So do you think something that's more like local, more like community engagement, is more effective than like some broad policy that affects like everyone nationally kind of a thing?
Depends on how the policy is being made, but yeah, if it's a national thing, that would make sense, because somebody in rural Nebraska and people in West Philly are probably going to approach things differently. Except for sex.
So, okay. Oh, yeah.
That, I think, also goes back to the idea of the population being studied as a them. It does change. I mean, and what this reminds me of Dick Gregory's line, he was asked to describe discrimination in the United States in the 1960s. He said, in the South, they don't care how close you get as long as you don't get too big. In the North, they don't care how big you get as long as you get too close. And it just the things that people were sensitive to and the way they responded to them were very different.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, Dick, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Big and close, I didn't get that.
I apologize. But just that when you look at a population that you're studying, two people can look at the same population and see them as the other for different reasons. And then when you want to impose an intervention, the fact that you want to generalize it beyond the small community, you have to be very careful that you're actually looking at that community, that the community also is being a similar community in other places. Even though you would see them as the same, they see themselves as the same.
Okay, let's continue. What time is it? Okay, good. I wanted to... One of the things that I found appealing was, in Sobo's piece, the few times that she focuses on self-efficacy as a variable in how women are making their decisions, you know, and how they feel pressures. Just because every time I see self-efficacy, it goes to my whole sort of reinvention of autonomy concept. You know, that it's not that you have these choices open, but it's what choices do you have and what ability do you have to act upon those choices. I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about her two narrative ideas. You know, sort of trying to understand what is it in the larger culture that has relevance to this population that influences a person's self-efficacy, their worldview, how they understand themselves in the world, how they understand how they relate to others. And she lays out two, the wisdom narrative and the monogamy narrative, and how both of those narratives have direct impacts on people's behavior. Do I need to separate you three? You two are so, you three are so funny back there. You've been laughing and giggling the whole class.
Us?
Yeah.
I don't know. I was just interacting with the class. So
no, I know. I'm not. Every time I look over here, so I keep thinking, is there something come out of my nose? Is my hair sticking up? Did I say something? So the wisdom narrative and the monogamy narrative.
Which page is that?
Oh, middle of the article?
Oh, the page.
Yeah, I don't know.
468.
Is it Sobo?
Yeah,
Sobo. Where she's... Yeah. Yep. The main reason that women engage in unsafe sex has less to do with the economics than with condoms, semiotics, and women's social and affective needs as for status and esteem. And the narratives both relate to what she calls the optimistic bias. And that's something that, if we're talking about generalizability, I think the optimistic bias is something that applies across populations, disease categorizations. It's why people do take action that is sort of counter to what an outsider would see as sort of a risk-benefit analysis. And that optimistic bias, you know, is the idea that, well, everyone else really needs to worry, but I don't, you know. Like, sure, people don't drive well, so everyone should really wear a seatbelt, but I'm a really good driver, so I don't need to wear my seatbelt. Nothing will happen to me.
Dora, can I ask a question about mm-hmm. that? Because I'm also very familiar with, there's a lot of research out there with about people who are prone to genetic diseases which they have no control over whatsoever, and there can't be anything done about them, so they're bad. I mean, Huntington's is a classic example. And they have exactly the opposite bias. They presume that they have it. So it's a very negative framework. So they don't get tested because I know I've got it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the flip side of the same coin, or am I not understanding this bias?
Well, that's interesting. I don't have a ready response because I hadn't thought about that. Anybody want to jump in?
Well, I just thought this made me think about in intro to psych years ago when I learned about like the different explanatory models that people can have. Like, so some people will, you know, be more likely to think about it affecting everyone else but them, and with the same statistic, the same, you know, another person could think that they definitely are going to fall into like the worst, you know, outcome. So mm-hmm. it could just be like some people are, you know, different people.
And I know what you're saying.
Different ways,
and that is true for sure. Some people react differently, but there have been all these studies about genetics and mm-hmm. which show that for Huntington's, the classic one, I think it's 12% of the people get tested because they believe they're going to have it. They don't want to know. There's nothing they can do about it, and mm-hmm. it's just total. It's going to happen to me anyway.
We see that with Alzheimer's, now there's genetic testing for Alzheimer's as well.
It's a little bit higher because mm-hmm. it's not so clear cut. The ties are more tenuous, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, with Huntington's, it's a very clear marker. You have it. If you live that long, you're going to die in disease. Mm-hmm. That's the reality of it. With Alzheimer's, there's a risk. It's not 100% surety.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit different, so a higher percentage get tested, but it's sure nowhere closer. But still, you have the same negative perception of, it runs in my family, so-and-so had it, my mom died of it, I know I'm going to get it.
I think, yeah, I mean, you could spend a whole semester talking about public perceptions of genetics and how it plays out differently in different disease populations and different populations. So kind of my gut instinct is I don't necessarily want to make a direct analogy from genetic things to non-genetic things, but I'm not sure if I'm, yeah.
Well, my son, the psychologist, actually answered this one for me, which is that for Huntington's disease, there's no upside. It's all downside. And you tend to go with the downside. Where the lottery ticket, you know, it's all mostly upside. There's very little downside. And it's really how you perceive the risks and the benefits. And if the return on the benefits is greater than the expense of the risks, then you're going to tend to focus more on the benefits than on the risks. But if the return on if the cost of the risk is going to be greater than the return on the benefit, then you're less likely.
So I'm not sure if you just made an argument that this is the flip side of optimistic bias.
Well, the optimistic bias is because somehow the person perceives a benefit to the conduct, and then that return on the benefit of that conduct is greater than the risk associated with that conduct.
So the benefit of not using the condom.
Yeah.
Is greater than the risk of using it, to the consequence of.
There's a gain in there somewhere. It may be having a stable relationship, it may be having a child, it may be.
Or as she says, it's the sort of self presentation, or it's this enactment of self mm-hmm. through this wisdom narrative. As she says, that the idea is that to maintain a sense of self, to say that you are a wise person, you have to be able to tell the good from the bad. So, no, you don't want to use a condom because you have that wisdom narrative that I am able to do this. And she says that unsafe sex is preferable, the benefit, the risk, to damaging one's self-esteem by saying, I am not wise enough to be able to make this distinction. And that's why, you know, at some point, one of the women says, you know, really what you should do is bring in some healthy-looking people with HIV. Because we have this perception, this, you know, that people with HIV look sick. You know, which makes sense. If you do sort of a visual analytical history of how HIV has been presented, dying men in the hospital, you know, with, you know, just, they look horrible. They're dying. And that's not the picture for everybody. And then related to that, the monogamy narrative, where this generic particular again, same thing we see with the optimistic bias. Well, everyone else needs to worry, but not me. All men cheat, except for mine. Because I am, and that's where she says they work, the narratives work together. And what she says is that's why when you see sort of blame for betraying the monogamous, or blame for betrayal, blaming the monogamy or the wisdom narratives, absolves the woman of responsibility. Because, how does she explain that? That it's, you know, it's not, how does she say that? I wrote it down and it seemed crystal clear, and now I'm, blaming men for betraying the monogamy or wisdom narrative absolves women of blame or responsibility. Why is that now striking me as wrong? Did I miss a verb?
Well, it's that mm-hmm. bad man who tricked me into thinking that he was good. Mm-hmm. It's not my fault, but
right, okay, so that relates then to when they said why the ones that did have an HIV test, and they said, well, you don't wear condoms, which is a risk-benefit, why are you taking the HIV test, which is sort of the same sort of thing, that this is sort of a special occasion test, and it doesn't fundamentally impact the narratives that they're telling about themselves, because it's not a longer-going issue. I thought that she was very persuasive in talking about the narratives. Because I could see, you know, again, obviously in very distinct ways, but yeah, the actions we make contribute to the story that we tell about ourselves. Of course. And she was framing these stories in a similar way that Whitehead did, as sort of generalizable gendered stories, but that play out in a particular way in a particular setting. And that I appreciated. I'm watching the clock, and I do want to talk about the Whitehead piece, but I want to get to your question about policy. And I think one of her clearest sort of how do we take this data and apply it to sort of policies is, you know, where she goes with, on page 476, the standard curricula is insulting. That example on page 477, and I'll give you a chance to look at it and see if you marked it as well. And I thought this was also a brilliant methodological thing, that if you have these focus groups talking about perceptions of HIV, it's ethical to then bring in an HIV educator to answer the questions that have been raised. I like that. And then to turn around and use the observations of the educational session as part of your data, I thought was brilliant. So the story of this educator, a white woman, discussing HIV tests and, you know, why they're always important, because even with steady partners often cheat, and the 6 month seropositivity lag, she reminded the women that only the most committed couple could reach the point of condomless intimacy. The educator then announced that she and her future husband had been tested. She told the women how happy she was that she would never again have to worry about using condoms. Without realizing it, the educator had told the women that condoms were bothersome, and more importantly, that she was different from them, as her man would not cheat. So sort of her own optimistic bias. but that plays out differently when she's in a position of relative authority, if she's the educator coming in. And, I mean, I don't know what her socioeconomic status is, but... And the other part that I thought was an interesting observation is that telling women, which so many preventive prevention and safer sex programs do, you know, insist on a condom. Insist on it. You know, threatening no sex if no condom. She says it reinforces all that negative symbolic load that comes with condoms. So ways of perhaps reframing the prevention dialogue and the fact that using condoms take away all of those meanings, you know, that Whitehead outlines. You don't trust me, you think I'm sleeping around, I'm diseased, I think you're diseased. And trying to reframe it in the sense of this is just what loving partners do may be an interesting policy shift, which again is going to have to be an R21, which is going to turn into an RL1, and then you can get your big study, and then you can submit it to a, you know, somebody on some panel somewhere who will write the policy. But that's actually a very interesting question. In fact, I was told by someone in this office who wanted to do some sort of study, and I said, no, they want numbers because they want to influence policy. And it was just sort of like, all right, you have just shot down everything that I believe in as an academic and sort of my, you know, academic worth. So I was really, you know, when I eventually get free time 7 years from now, I'm going to try to do a study that sort of says, where, you know, like a participant, do a qualitative study with policymakers, you know, the staffers or whoever, where are they getting their information from? How is that information actually conveyed to the policymakers? Where is discussion generated? What is given more weight? I think the question isn't studied, and it needs qualitative research to actually study it. Okay.
That's something you point to, but you need to measure sort of the outcome of the policies.
Right. Yeah. There's my numbers, yes. But how do you study that? Yeah. I mean, general survey monkey to all D.C. policymakers. Have you been?
Was it effective? So in other words...
Yes, that's the second part, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The policy that's implemented effective. So the information that led up to that policy decision, mm-hmm. what was the dynamics around that? But then was the outcome good?
Right. Because in my fantasy world, the quantitative data results in a lot more policy, which is a lot more ineffective. Mm-hmm. Or ineffective. I mean, it doesn't have to be bad. It could just not have an effect. You know what I mean? And that the qualitative stuff, which when it does find its way to being used, actually does make a difference. That's my fantasy paper. All right. Let's turn our attention to the Whitehead piece. Because again, remember, what I'm eventually hoping to get us to... Well... how do we incorporate gender as a variable when we're talking about culture and competency and how, you know, sort of, this is more of a population base as opposed to a practitioner base, but how do we throw gender into the soup? Okay. I have about 6 pages of things that I thought Whitehead is admirable for. But I want to turn the floor over to you guys first and see if there was anything that bubbled to the surface that's either particularly illuminating, convincing, and on the flip side, problematic.
I guess thinking about how gender, you have to consider gender with socioeconomic status, I liked what you said about how the poor black man might, sex might be his only means of expressing his strength or masculinity. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have a job. So that's an instance where the socioeconomic status and gender are sort of affecting each other.
Yeah, he uses the term fragmented, in terms of fragmented masculinity, which I think you could use the same term with Sobo's 2 narratives. You know, when the narrative is intact, it's when it is broken that there's some sort of a fractured sense of self, and that's why we work so hard to maintain that sense of self. So, but he has this idea that, and he goes back to sort of, was it the plantation economy? He has a better term.
Yeah.
Plantation America, which he extends to inner cities, you know, and talks about, and you see this internationally as well. Some of the wealthiest areas, which are more primarily European, surrounding or looking down on densely populated, you know, all the problems in the sort of the inner city. I want to see what you guys thought of this argument, because it's one of his keys. So that if sort of the nature of a man is this identity that incorporates sociopolitical power, or even self-efficacy, we don't need to take it all the way in terms of power, but just sort of maybe even self-control, I think we could argue, or not self-control, but efficacy, we'll use that term again, financial, and then sexual. Because that, to me, and maybe it is because it is touching upon one of the more stereotyped, talked about features of sexuality, which is the sexuality of black men, sort of that's where I sort of read that and go, ooh, where's this going? You know, it makes me inherently uncomfortable just because of what a minefield it is. And I'm, like you, more sensitive to generalizations when things are minefields. It makes me a little nervous. So what he's saying is that it's the fragment itself, masculine fragmentation due to low levels of economic and sociopolitical status may contribute to men's exaggeration of their sexual capacities, exaggeration of their need to sexually control and or conquer females, and it's this fragment itself, he says, what does all that have to do with AIDS? Behavior that increases HIV transmission risk. And again, don't think, what do I think about this? What data is he providing to support this argument? Yeah.
Well, I liked how he also broke it down by age as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought it was really relevant to his point later that older men should, you know, interact more with younger men and tell them about their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really interesting that he actually provided, I think he provided data to support that younger mm-hmm. men are more likely to think of sexual prowess as in that triangle of like manliness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it is, young people generally have, and this is one of the things where he talks about sort of masculinity across the board. All teenage boys overemphasize one of, I mean, if we buy his argument that this is sort of the triangle of masculinity, you know, teenage boys don't have the first two. Social status, male, female. One of the pieces of evidence that I thought was supportive of this is when he talks about, he uses the example of the woman who says, at least in jail I can feel like a man. I thought that was a very powerful comment. I think he even says, you know, away from the accusing eyes of my family and community. And some of the male focus group members themselves commenting on this exact triad. I think they point out, you know, Wall Street guys, you know, they do the same thing, fight with their reputation over respectability. But they can just either hide it better, they have a global stage in which to have a reputation over respectability that it's easier to not see. If you didn't read the article, what I'm talking about there is he makes a distinction between respectability, which is this identity that has economic power, provides for the family, being law-abiding, winning through competing successfully, and a sort of Judeo-Christian sense of morality and fair play, versus reputation, which is founded upon sexual prowess, defiance of authority, and general rowdiness, and winning through gamesmanship or outsmarting others. And he is quite prolific. I mean, this article alone has been cited over 100 times. And I looked to see if he was still at Maryland, and he is. And this consortium, or what is it that he's working with, project, Cultural Systems Analysis Group, that's still going on. And he's considered, in general, a very authoritative presence in all of this, with Haiti and in the United States. So he also is able then to provide a lot of cross-cultural examples. He even brings sort of West Indian examples. So what does this all have to do with AIDS? And this is where, he says gender identity. His hypothesis, or his conclusion, is failure to live up to the ideal leads to a retreat from the system and to high rates of joblessness, drug addiction, alcoholism, and homelessness, all direct or indirect risk factors for HIV and AIDS. And again, with the sort of age gap, too, and sort of the certain type of drug dealers looking down on the crack dealers. And this is one of those things like, what's different? You know, sort of the drug scene is different. It's still rampant and out there, but maybe how it plays out is different. The overt control over women and adolescent girls, sort of looking at sort of the inability to get more mature women, and spread of HIV rates among adolescent girls, and the incarceration epidemic, which are instruments of destruction, he says, in communities. Yeah.
So I really appreciate his attempt to historically construct how factors may have come into play starting from the plantation age.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder, when I read this, I thought about my own understanding of history and of literature, and I felt that there are some points where I might have disagreed. And obviously, I have a perspective that is not necessarily representative of what necessarily are patterns. But for example, when he talks about the black woman as a whore and how in plantation America, that women of darker colors were seen as seductresses, I felt that he ignored the fact that, for a large part in literature, women have always been treated as the one inviting sexual misconduct between them and men. In a lot of literature, it's the man who is innocent, and the woman seduces him. And it's not until contemporary fiction that role is reversed, that the man is the one who seduces the woman and she's innocent. And I feel like, you know, at least in that case, you know, why are black... I mean, yes, black women might have a different role, but, you know, that's ignoring the fact that women, you know, regardless of race, have always been seen as seductresses up until this period. And then I think about, you know, like Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, and I think that she offers a different explanation for why black women are marginalized even within the African-American community. And so I really like his historical approach, but I wonder, you know, how strong it is, because I think it's much more anecdotal than it is, you know, backed necessarily by any sort of like historical evidence, because he simply cites, you know, he says like, this is how it was, and so this is the link, and it is a strong link. But then when I think about what I've learned, I think, well, there are other links, right? Like there are other explanations that have been offered by people that I've read through literary and historical sources, which obviously aren't explanations for why this is, but it offers something different.
And that's the problem of induction with all of this sort of information from a genuine, you know, generalize it.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at it from a certain perspective, there could be many other threads that sort of, you know, could be woven into the sort of people miss that you know, people see from a different perspective. So it's very difficult to sort of take a set of data and generalize it. I don't know what others think about that, but
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to figure out, because every time I hear about particulars in settings, I get really excited, and I think it's full of potential. And what I hear often is that it's limiting and problematic. So I'm trying to put my finger on what is it and why do I find it so exciting and full of potential.
I don't know what you mean by particular sense setting.
The specifics to a particular case, like the, you know, this is a group of inner city African American men in Baltimore in the 90s.
Okay.
I don't have that same I don't have that same reaction of, I don't know how I feel because it's too particular. How do we fit? Yeah.
Maybe you get excited because I know, like Dr. Jamon over at the School of Nursing does a lot of research in this area, and she uses like Whitehead, and then she used some of her own work to develop, and now she has like this whole peer-to-peer. She works in black urban barbershops, and she like developed an application on the iPad, and so now the barbers are the ones who are teaching the people in the community about safe sex, and you know, it's all coming together, so maybe that's why you get excited, because I got excited reading this, because immediately I was like, oh my gosh, this is all... You know, this was in the 90s, and it stemmed, like, this amazing research that's going on now, and it was because of the richness and the qualitative data that people started looking at things differently, and a new approach was developed, and now this could have a significant impact. You know, that's the beauty of qualitative research. It might not be completely generalizable, but there might be one small part of it that you could take and totally run with, and it could be really successful. So maybe that's one reason why.
And maybe it's just, maybe it's something like personality types. You know, there are certain personality types that get, that respond to questions in particular ways, and others that don't. And it's a sort of, you know, we got to go to the developmental psychology literature to understand, you know. So maybe sort of developmental psychology leads to these fundamentally different outlooks on, you know, sort of how the world works. And one aspect of how the world works is what is considered viable information or valuable information. Or not that one is valuable and one is not, but how do we prioritize and hierarchize what we choose to use. I'm going to make that as a homework assignment for myself to see how I can take some of this and, I don't know, give you a peer-reviewed article to prove my point in the right form of data.
No, I think all these points, though, are not inconsistent. Okay.
No, yes.
They're very consistent. So, I mean, so for example, it's, you know, people would use the qualitative data, I guess, of, you know, to sort of to try to generalize it by reading in, you know, sort of from their own perspective what they thought that sort of meant, and that's where they come up with policy decisions. But the sort of, you know, sort of on the ground community data that we're talking about is this sort of is sort of the virtual cycle of, you know, of data, realization of it, outcome, figuring out what works, modifying, and then sort of moving on. It's sort of this learning, sort of, learning on the ground sort of approach. And that, you know, that comes from the qualitative data, but that's a different direction. It's the induction direction gets you into trouble, but it's the, you know, it's sort of the practical, you know, sort of direction that gets modified as it's sort of moving along where it's, you know, where it makes some sense. Because that's the way I sort of look at some of this.
And if we want to bring it back down to the level of individuals dealing with other individuals, away from the global policy level, the awareness of diversity that qualitative research brings and the form of analysis that good qualitative research illuminates, I think can only benefit an individual in new situations and new encounters. I mean, I talk to potential MBE students all the time, and they say, well, why should I do this? Why should I do this degree? And I talk about it sort of as a toolkit. You know, whatever it is you're interested in, this degree and this approach will provide lenses and tools for you to approach what it is that you are doing. So I guess that's
hypothesis
generally. Yeah. Right, which goes to my whole anthropologists never have a hypothesis. We come out with hypotheses.
Well, you know, right from the data you can generate hypotheses, and then, you know, and then you keep generating new hypotheses, and then the question is how do you implement them? That's where sort of the community approach has been sort of effective, because it gets that being real immediately.
Right, and that's where the localized money is too. You know, we can't forget, if we're gonna spend time talking about structural barriers on African Americans in the inner city, we also need to talk about structural barriers on policymakers.
Absolutely.
there was another point here that I thought that I'm surprised nobody, and that was my first one when I said sort of what does Whitehead bring to the table? Is his elucidation of how inadequate the three general categories of sexuality are. Are you homosexual? Are you heterosexual? Are you bisexual? He's got five. The whole spectrum. And that, so that if you're, again, there's a piece of evidence. If you're talking about a policy, you know, we have to highlight, you know, bisexual and homosexual men. If you've got men who are occasionally having sex with men who don't identify as bisexual or homosexual, they're going to ignore that message. So I thought that was a very clear, immediate, whoa, okay, which may again lead to further research. How can we reach these people? How widespread are men who occasionally have sex with men who don't consider themselves bisexual?
I really like that. My my impression, though, is that most HIV/AIDS research, at least since this time, mm-hmm. has become sensitive yes. to that fact. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't quite so novel to me. But mm-hmm. Yeah, it's obviously an important factor mm-hmm. in his study.
Maybe this can be our first case study for how qualitative research leads to sort of change. The exploration of a broader spectrum of sexual behaviors. What else? We have like 5 minutes, 10-ish left. Anybody going to walk out of here going, oh, I wish I would have had said my comment. One thing to think about is perhaps sort of to abstractly sort of take a meta lesson from this week, separate from the HIV data, is in what ways is gender studied in a similar way to culture, and in what ways is it studied in a very distinct way? So that if you do find yourself in the position of being a grant writer or, you know, organizing a program of some sort, the awareness that gender and class and ethnicity have to work together, and they work together in very particular ways. Because I do find it interesting that in a lot of the cultural competency literature, I mean, a handful of times in what we've read so far this semester has highlighted gender as a complicating factor to the variable of culture. Which is interesting. You know, are we assuming that culture trumps gender? Or are we making sort of a, what would that be, sex is to gender as race is to ethnicity? You know, I don't know what's going on there, but I think it's interesting.
Would you consider gender part of culture, though?
Yes.
I mean, that's the sort of the construct, or I don't know if it's a construct, but that's the, it's not to have a problem, have a problem sort of understanding, but all of these different categories, if you may, make up culture. Mm-hmm. So they can all can interrelate in some way, shape, or form and have sort of an effect over on all of culture that's constantly.
Well, I think in general, society is much more willing to accept that ethnicity is constructed. I don't think we're there yet with gender. So that's why, originally I had in my notes, sexist to gender is racist to ethnicity, but I'm like, that's not a good equivalence.
Well, maybe to reinforce the idea that gender is subsumed would be to return to the data that you mentioned at the beginning of class. It seemed that you were talking about gender disparities, but I saw the sense that most of the explanations were culturally based. So there's this disparity between the genders in terms of health reporting and health mm-hmm. outcomes. But it seems that culture is cited as maybe the overarching reason that these disparities are manifested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that's a jumble of things that doesn't get me excited. Because that's the jumble of things, and I'm like, how does one then develop studies that can have so many variables? And then you say you can't, so you gotta,
that's where my head's at. So how do I make sense of this? Mm-hmm. But you don't. Just getting back to the other point, heard what you were saying also. But you don't have to say that gender is a culturally constructed phenomenon to say that it's important within the context of culture.
Right. True. And could be differentially important in different cultures.
Because that's what I thought that these articles were sort of about. Yeah. It was the importance, not necessarily whether they were constructed or not, but mm-hmm. sort of the importance within the context of the problem that they were.
Right. A mediating factor to. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure this is too out of context, but in biology there is a theory that for some reason, the concept of gender in a big population, when the population starts growing without control, there is a biological mechanism that tries to reverse that concept of gender from female and male to prevent the growing of the population, like in natural control. So,
are we talking about humans or another organism?
We are talking about in general. That okay. could happen in humans, could happen in other species, for example. The male is the one who carry the offspring. Mm-hmm. There are some species that do that. And they have been studies to say when that switch happens, when that happens, that it went from the female to the male. And they attribute that to the natural control or the...
Wait, what went from the female to the male? Or the males, control over sexuality?
Well, no, when we think about female and male and female, we're talking about reprocreation, for example, that we always attribute the female carry the offspring, uh-huh. and the male does not.
Hunts.
Yeah. So there are populations in certain species that has been reversed.
Okay.
And they think that perhaps in humans that's what's happening, because now we have more, of course there is more information about the gender, mm-hmm. and why somebody feel as a female or male in a different body, mm-hmm. and they attribute that it's possible that because we are expanding so much, in humans can happen the same as...
So transgenderism is an evolutionary adaptation to overpopulation? Wow. Oh, I don't know if I want to open this discussion up.
It's not about the transgender point, but I think maybe to clarify, or at least what I've been reading, like in popular culture, like
okay.
Psychology Today did a report on how like gender roles are being changed and how like men are becoming boys. And this idea that like women have more control over like the dating process now, and I don't know if that's what you're talking about, but this like traditional conceptualizations of like the gender norms that you know the man like hunts and carries the bread, and the woman the one who takes care of the child, and like that's getting reversed in a lot of cases or challenged with women working more or like you know women having more power and choosing you know like. Who their spouse is, and I don't know if that's what you're trying.
No, this okay, is no more.
Maybe it's a transgender.
This is more.
Well, you know, I would recommend everyone listen last week's Double X podcast, and again, not Double X Racy, but Double X Two Chromosomes. It's the editors of Slate. Actually, we're talking exactly about this issue of that somebody was arguing about development or evolutionary. Developments of sort of genders, and the other woman was like, that's like 10 billion leaps to go from, you know, evolutionary process to contemporary politics, and that was the exact nature of the debate. Okay. Although I'm now intrigued, and I'm... as of now, there's nothing to read for next week. But I have been talking with Dr. Redhawk a lot in the past weeks, and she's developing what I think is going to be a really interesting and different type of class. And that's one of the things that I try to do in this class, is not just keep it in one particular style, which is why we occasionally do group work, why we do this. And she's our sort of subject. We can study her and use her as a key informant to, all right, we've been talking about race, we've been talking about class, we've been talking about gender. How do all of those things, coupled with a Philadelphia environment, coupled with contemporary state of HMOs and reimbursements and the financial aspect, which she has dealt with, how does that all, what does that soup look like, and what does it look like from the perspective of somebody in it, from the practitioner side? I will, if she does want you to read something, you know, it'll be like one article, if that, and I...
No.
Oh.
No problem.
And I just found this article the other day. It's from 1987, and it's Paying the Price, Medical Care Minorities and the Newly Competitive Healthcare System. So that's over 20 years ago. I think this is going to be really interesting, and it may, if it is interesting, it's sort of, I like to see what people hypothesize is going to happen. So I'll let you know if this pans out. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.